welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Just in time for Halloween, my guest today, John Woolley, the host of Public Radio Tulsa's Swing on This, is out with a new book inspired by the pulp fiction suspense horror genre of the 1920s and 30s. John, in addition to being a nationally renowned expert on Western swing music, is also an expert in a number of subgenres within popular culture, two being the pulp fiction tradition and the horror genre in books and film. He's the author of numerous titles in both categories, and his latest book is the second book in a three-book trilogy titled Satan's Swine, The Cleansing, Book 2. Written with co-author Robert A. Brown, the project began with a series of letters Brown sent to Woolley, telling a story from the 1930s about a WPA Writers Project folklore collector who runs into strange goings-on in a small town deep in the Arkansas mountains. The letters were written to him on 30 stationery with vintage stamps. From that start, the Cleansing series began, using the letter format and vintage typewriter typeface. Woolley will be reading and talking about the book tonight at 7 o'clock at Magic City Books, and he joins us to talk about the book today on Studio Tulsa. John Woolley, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Just in time for Halloween, you have this new book and signing tonight. This is the second book you've co-written with Robert A. Brown. And as I understand it, there's a very interesting backstory about how these books came about.
Well, Robert and I go back to the 60s, Rich, and we were friends in the 60s. We were comic book and pulp magazine collectors and collected old movie material and stuff. And then our lives kind of took different directions, and I came here and Robert stayed down around the Oklahoma City area. And I went into professional writing, and Robert was in a school administration in Oklahoma City. And so he always wanted to write, and just somehow it never quite happened with him. He did a little some articles and things and became very well known as a nostalgia collector all over the world. He's really well known. Well, one day, I guess, gosh, it was about 15 years ago, I got a letter from Robert, but it was in an airmail envelope from the 1930s with an airmail stamp from the 1930s on it. And I opened it up, and it was on this little sheet of airmail paper from the 30s.
Very thin.
Very thin, almost onion skin, and typed with a manual typewriter. And he was telling me about some of the things that had happened to him with his new job with the WPA Folklore Project. Well, I was pretty sure.
It was written in his own voice.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, from the very beginning. John, I arrived here, and it's like, and I couldn't figure it out. Robert is a very interesting guy. He has a very interesting angle of vision and always has. And so I wondered what's going on. And then the next day or two, I got another one and another one. And he had taken on, it was his persona, but he'd taken on the persona of a guy who was sent, he'd been with the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, and in 1939, he goes to work for the WPA, and he's on the Folklore Project, and he's collecting stories from older people out in the hills of Arkansas. And it took me a month or two to realize, you know, Robert may want to be collaborating on a book on this. This may be what this is all about. Because it was really amusing. I started really looking forward to letters. Well, so I wrote him back, and we started going on, and sure enough, that's what happened. We ended up, and it took years, many years, in fact, before we actually collaborated on what became The Cleansing, which is a trilogy. And the book I have out now, Satan's Swine, that we just had come out, is the second in the trilogy.
So what was your first reaction when you received this letter? I mean, you just thought, oh, what a weird joke or a funny joke? Or?
Let's just say it wasn't out of character for Robert at all. I have gotten very unusual correspondence from him in different ways over
the years. My guess is you get a lot of unusual correspondence from a lot of devotees.
We do. We get a lot of unusual correspondence. We kind of encourage that, you know. whether it's on Swing on This or whether it's writing. But, yeah, it looked like just something else. I thought, gosh, this is really interesting, because Robert's always been a very interesting guy. And he started doing this, and I kept wanting to get the letter to see what happened next.
He really was doing a pulp thing.
He was very much. We are both big pulp magazine fans. For those who may not know what that is, back in the day, the heyday was really the 20s and 30s and, of course, into the 40s before paperback books and comic books sort of came along and stole a lot of their thunder. pulps were these all-fiction magazines published on pulp paper, very low-grade paper, with garish, glossy covers of all kinds of genres. There were the ones like Argosy and Blue Book that had adventure, had mystery, had science fiction. Then there were specific ones like Black Mask and Dime Detective that were detective pulps, and Weird Tales, which is kind of where we're coming from. Weird Tales and strange stories, and these were the horror pulps.
Now, for those who don't know Weird Tales, and I have never read Weird Tales, but I've read a lot about this.
Yes.
They really were sort of the inspiration for things like The Twilight Zone,
mm-hmm.
and these were really big in the 20s and 30s.
Big in the 20s and 30s,
and they've had a following all the way today. There's still Weird Tales coming out now.
There
revivals.
Are. Yeah, there are, and there are a lot of the stories that were first published in Weird Tales pulps have been anthologized everywhere. Some of the more famous stories, Lovecraft especially, H.P. Lovecraft stories, they first appeared in the Weird Tales and other pulps like that. And then, of course, subsequently went to the movies. But Weird Tales was it was out of Chicago, very influential publication. And it was, you know, when people say, we've had a lot of people say, well, this book is an old school horror. Now, it is. That doesn't mean that, you know, it doesn't have its moments of gore and stuff. But there's also, if you read a lot of Lovecraft, and of course, Lovecraft had some sort of, what would you say, some things that were not maybe as commendable as the atmosphere that he set, because his characters tended not to be very good. He was more interested in the atmosphere and that. But we come from there in trying to craft a scene, a situation where horror threatens at all times the protagonist.
Yeah, I would say this is almost more of a suspenseful tale than what I would think of a horror thing where it's about slashing and gore,
right,
and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's really more of a suspenseful tale. And it sort of reminds me of a lot of media that is inspired by that pulp mm-hmm. idea or serialization where, mm-hmm. you know, you get to the end of the episode and what's going to happen next.
Right. What's going to happen next? That's true. And I would say that it is suspense, but it's also occult suspense. And that's sort of what makes it a horror, is there's not a lot of times in suspense things, it's what seems to be horror turns out just to be a person, and there's an logical explanation. There's not an art. We're coming straight out of a horror and magic kind of thing.
I guess after a month or so of these letters, and they're coming like every few days.
Yes, they are.
You said, hey, this could be a book.
That's right. That's right. So I called up Robert, and we got to talking about it. And of course, Robert is older than I am. He's in his 70s, late 70s. Now he is. He was in his early 70s then when we started out. And, you know, I finally realized he has decided that he wants to do a book. And so the two of us got together, and I've written a few books, a few novels as well as nonfiction books. And so I started in on it and started working. We started working together on things like foreshadowing, on things like character development, on plot points and different things like that. And as it came along, Robert still was writing the letters, and then I was taking them and changing things around and going back, and Robert would change a few things. So it was a true collaboration.
And you kept the form, too, of this monologic epistolary novel.
I like that. Monologic epistolary. That's exactly right. Yeah.
So it's a series of letters from Robert mm-hmm. to you.
That's right.
There is a fictional device about it.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of Oklahoma.
But I was actually born in Minnesota.
Were you?
Oh, yeah.
I know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
St. Paul boy.
Yep. So you grew up there. He's come to the South to work on the WPA Writers Project, and he's starting to send you these letters of this story day after day after day.
That's right.
And many times several packets within a day.
Yeah, he'll be gone for a few days, and then you'll get a big bunch of them or something. And the thing we should say here is about the protagonist, Robert, is that he also has, and the name of the first book was Seventh Sense, he also has a kind of a way of feeling things and that he calls his seventh sense. It's kind of beyond a sixth sense, but he can see things and sometimes feel things. It's scattershot.
It's almost like a flash of,
exactly,
of foreboding,
yes,
a flash of warning.
Mm-hmm.
It's very ephemeral.
Yeah, it is ephemeral. And he's had it his whole, you know, and sometimes it's with, you know, negligible kinds of things, like when he can, when he knew that he was going to win the shotgun at the giveaway at the movie theater in their hometown. And sometimes it's very, it becomes very important to his survival.
Yeah. So in the cleansing books, it's 1939. Robert Brown is working for the WPA Writers Project, collecting folklore deep in the hills of Arkansas, a little town that's made up. And it's, yes. But this idea of the writers going out into the rural areas, I guess it ended up in the state guides that were published by the WPA.
Absolutely.
These are apparently a treasure trove of information about what life was like in the 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. And so this is the device that he uses to
That's right.
This.
And as you know, Rich, they were putting a lot of writers and things to work. The WPA was doing a lot of projects with writers. And you're right, the stuff that they came up with, and you know, a lot of the writers that we have today, even here in Oklahoma, Angie DeBow, of course, was very involved in the writers' projects in the Oklahoma, as you say, the state histories that came out then. And so was Jim Thompson. That's right. Another one. Jim Thompson worked for Angie DeBow. And there's two great figures from Oklahoma, great literary figures from Oklahoma.
Yeah, so he's here to collect folklore stories.
Yes.
He comes into Maccaville, and all of a sudden, the seventh sense goes off from the very start.
Yes.
And he finds himself getting into a weirder and weirder situation. Now, I haven't read The Seventh Sense, but it seems like it from the very get-go, he knows he's in trouble. And instead of doing the sensible thing and leaving town, he says, nope, I'm here to collect these stories.
That's right. Well, he's a writer, you know, and all writers have wonderful character. You know, when you get a writer started on something, they just kind of keep hold of it. But yeah, that's right. And he feels like it's something that he needs to do. And that may be part of the seventh sense as well, that he feels like he has an overriding passion to find out what's at the bottom of all of this.
Yeah. The story begins with him running across a hat by Old Man Black,
yes.
Who's apparently appropriately named because there's some black magic associated with him.
There is, that's right. Essentially, without giving too much away, in the first book, Old Man Black sort of emerges as the main antagonist. He's part of these different people, as Robert has come to find out, are associated with different totems, and this goes clear back to Africa. Because the people who live in Maccaville, many of them are descended from slaves. And so when they were brought over, they brought with them their totems. There was a cat or feline totem, and there was a snake, and there were hogs. And, of course, that translates in Africa. It's a little different. For instance, if your cat is your totem, you've got, you know, more impressive cats in Africa than you do in Arkansas. So there's a lot of Robert keeps running into all kinds of house cats that are somehow involved in all of this.
Yeah, but as the title would suggest, it's the swine that rule the roads.
Yeah, the swine are pretty much, king of the hill.
And the swine are pig people?
In some cases, yes.
I mean, basically, this is a world in which cats, pigs, and snakes are and aren't what they seem.
Exactly. That's exactly right, because sometimes, for instance, Old Man Black was able to control snakes. And sometimes you think perhaps that these people are looking out through the eyes of the animals, the hogs certainly, the snakes, even the cats, that there are people behind them that are actually looking out of the eyes of these animals.
Yeah.
And
I was going to say at the very beginning of the book, we're talking, he's holding a hat with a rattlesnake hat band that all of a sudden bites him.
That's right. And that's why he ends up in the hospital and almost dies at the end of the first, I mean, spoiler alert, but almost dies at the end of the first book.
Yeah. My guest today is John Woolley. He's a writer. He is a host of Swing on This here on Public Radio Tulsa. He is a devotee of all sorts of interesting things, the pulp, horror novels, and that all comes together in this series that he's co-written with Robert A. Brown, titled, the second new book is titled Satan Swine, The Cleansing Book 2. He'll be speaking about it tonight at Magic City Books at 7 o'clock and a reading. And why don't you read something from us?
You know, I'll be glad to do that. And this kind of may give you an idea when we talk about pulps and talk about the setting. The settings were always very important for the pulps, even though they had to be very breathless and fast. You wanted to have this kind of the idea of malevolence all around you if you were doing a horror thing. So In this particular part of the book, Robert has found a hideaway in the mountains in Arkansas that used to be used by outlaws and some really disreputable people after the Civil War. And he's in there, and he lies down, and he falls asleep. And he writes to John, after a little over an hour, according to my strap watch, I awoke, alarm bells ringing crazily inside my head. The fire was still glowing at the ends of a few logs, so I could see a little. And at first nothing looked wrong or out of place. As I lay there facing the cave's entrance, I focused on a couple of stars I spied through the crack in the top of my barricade. Then it hit me. I shouldn't be able to see those stars. I'd left a small gap in the rocks and logs so I could see directly outside. Somehow the hole had shifted to a different angle. So he pulls out a pistol and shoots. And then he says, leaping up, I ran to the barricade and kept firing out through the crack, moving the barrel back and forth. The ledge in front was narrow, so I figured my chances were good to hit anything that happened to be out there. I emptied the pistol, started reloading. As I shoved bullets in their chambers, I tried to listen through the ringing in my ears. Once the reverberations from the pistol had faded, it had become quiet as a tomb out there. No frogs, no crickets, no night birds, nothing. And although my hearing hadn't quite recovered, I distinctly picked up the sound of something blundering into that blow-down tangle of dead wood and brush on the ridge, followed by an awful howling. I'd been able to avoid honey locusts and their thorns while I was pulling logs and firewood out of there. Whatever this was hadn't been as lucky. So the howling stops after a while, and he says, not exactly how I'd planned to relax in the mountains, but as that Harvard prof from Austria, Schumpeter, said a while back, we always plan too much and think too little. The first rays of sunlight will be coming over the ridge back soon. I'll go outside then and see what I can find. I started to write, wish me luck, but by the time you get this, you'll know full well whether I had any luck or not.
And that probably ends a section, too.
It does indeed.
Again, you're taking that serialization idea, and it sounds like this was something, as this project went on, you said, hey, you know, when am I going to get the next letter?
Exactly. It did. And then, you know, and then you would, I would hate to get caught up, right? And then not have any more letters. And then you'd have to get Robert going on the letters. And then sometimes two or three would come in one day. And it was just, it was a pretty, I've never done anything like this before. I've collaborated a lot. I'm a pretty good collaborator. You know, Ron Wolf and I had that series of horror novels to collaborate on in the 80s. But I'd never collaborated in a situation like this, and it was just wonderful.
What becomes apparent is that these totems can last generations.
Yes.
We see a character who was at one time a Buffalo soldier who's come to be in the 1930s.
That's right.
And very interesting part of the book there. And then I noticed you, both of you, decide to put in a little bit of your own influences, and at some part of the story, they end up in St. Louis.
Right.
And then there's a young poet named Richard who shows up.
That's right. And that was a character of my invention. I modeled him after Richard Wright, the great African-American novelist, who was actually one of my and is one of my favorite writers. And I happened to run onto him years ago while I was collecting pulps. And, you know, the old Story magazine looked a lot like pulps, same size and everything. And I picked up a Story magazine, and Richard Wright, it was the first time Richard Wright had been published. He had won a Story magazine contest for a part of what became Uncle Tom's Children. And I read that, and I was so knocked out by Richard Wright, and this just seemed like the right way to put him in to a piece of work. It would have been, I fudged a little bit on the years and everything, but if people look at the character of Richard, there's no doubt in my mind that it's based on Richard Wright.
Yeah. And of course, this is the thing about the Writers Project, was anybody who was a writer of any note after the war probably spent time in the Writers Project.
Absolutely.
I mean, John Cheever.
Yeah.
Saul Bellow was actually a young, working with Nelson Altgren and all sorts of people. And it's like all the stories of how very young writers sort of learned their craft with these older writers who were basically couldn't exist writing books. They had to do government work during the Depression.
Yeah, and especially poets. Of course, a lot of that hadn't changed. This was a way, and playwrights as well. Look at all the great playwrights that came out of the WPA projects. And this was a way of keeping, which is a wonderful thing, I think, a way of keeping America's artists' body and soul together during the Depression.
So once you decided to do this book, you decided to keep this letter form. That was a pretty early decision.
Very early decision.
Yeah. And as you were doing that, I assume when you decide to get to the point where you're doing a book, you kept this form right down to the manual typewriter font for the actual book. That was important.
Our editor, Laura Bernhardt, was the one that found that font for us. And it just works so well because it looks like it's been typed. And we made little things, little discoveries and things that sort of helped, I think, get the story across along the way like that. Yeah, yeah.
My guest today is John Woolley, a writer and host of Public Radio Tulsa's Swing on This. He's an accomplished writer with books on Western swing, on music, on comic books, as well as pulp fiction and horror books, and this sort of crosses at least a couple of those boundaries.
It does.
He's co-author of Satan's Swine, The Cleansing Book 2. He'll be speaking about the book tonight at Magic City Books at 7 o'clock, just in time for Halloween.
Yeah.
And this is a good read for Halloween. This is a spooky read.
Thank you very much, Rich. We're real proud of it. And the first book, Seven Sense, we got some great notices on it. People really seem to like this one, so we're delighted. It's taken Robert and me decades and decades to do this collaboration, and we're happy it's come off the way it has.
And I assume it has a following within the people that still follow pulps. And
yes.
You are a champion of sub-genres.
Yes.
And I assume that's one of those sub-genres.
It's pretty small. I mean, if we sold a copy of this to every pulp fan in the United States, I don't think we'd break 1,000. I mean, I go to pulp conventions every year. Uh-huh. We have two major pulp conventions in America every year, one in Pittsburgh and one in Chicago. And there are, 300, 400, 500 people there.
What's the attraction of that for you?
The attraction of that for me is the storytelling. I love to see how economically, the guys that I like, the writers I like, Steinbeck, James M. Cain, the people, Dashiell Hammett, who came right out of the pulps, came right out of Black Mask, the people who could just get right to the heart of a story. I love to see their storytelling. I love to see how they, just as a writer, to see how they put their stories together without, because in the pulps, you couldn't waste a word. You had to do, and it's helped me, being a pulp fan and reading a lot of pulps, I think it's helped me as a fiction writer, too.
I would think newspaper writing and pulp writing are probably, in many senses, the same sort of thing about being economical in telling the story in the fewest words possible.
And in very direct verbs, no passive voice. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Is there a book three in the works?
Yes. A book three's done.
Book three's
done. We just don't have a title. We did, we've done Seven Sense, we've done Satan's Swine, so we got that S's, we got the sibilance, and then we got adjective noun. But we know the third one is going to be something with serpent or serpents, but we can't find the adjective to go with that noun. And serpentine is the noun, is the adjective of the noun. We don't want to go with serpentine because that's kind of goofy. So we're still working on, but no, it's done. It's done, yeah. and ready to go. We're just looking for a title.
Does it all wrap up in book three?
It does.
Uh-huh.
It all wraps up in book three.
And for those who are maybe picking up Satan's Swine and haven't gone back to the Seventh Sense, what can you tell us about that book?
Well, Seventh Sense is, of course, the it starts out and establishes the characters that we see more of, like Old Man Black and Ma Steen at the boarding house, and of course, Robert and some of the others. And it is actually, the first, I guess there's, a page and a half or 2 pages that sort of synopsize the Seventh Sense, right, and the beginning of, mm-hmm, Satan's Swine, in case people want to just jump right into Satan's Swine. Of course, we'll have Seventh Sense at the book signing as well for you completists out there. anybody wants them both, we can do that.
All right, John Woolley, as always, it's a pleasure. Great read for Halloween. The Cleansing, book one and two, The Seventh Sense, and the new book, Satan's Swine.
Rich, can't thank you enough. It's great, as always.
Thank you. John Woolley is my guest today. He's a writer and the host of Public Radio Tulsa's Swing on This. His latest book in the Cleansing series is titled Satan's Swine. The first book in the series is titled The Seventh Sense. You can hear about both in a reading and signing tonight at Magic City Books at 7 o'clock. For more information, visit magiccitybooks.com. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Mark Dara.
When George W. Bush delivered the commencement address at Oklahoma State University near the nadir of his presidential popularity, protesters came and were promptly cordoned off to prevent disruptions of the event. One might wonder whether this police action infringed on the protesters' freedom of speech, a right recognized by the United States Constitution. The short answer is no. Governing authorities can impose restrictions on the time, place, and manner of speech, provided that the limitations are reasonable and content neutral. If a newspaper publishes a story that is false and thereby damages a private citizen's reputation, that private citizen can sue the newspaper for damage done to his or her reputation. The law allows this. Can a newspaper publish whatever it wants without being hauled into court to answer to the law? The First Amendment protects the freedom of the press, doesn't it? Yes. But in the United States, that freedom has always been limited by state laws against libel and slander. Suppose two people belong to a religious organization that prohibits medical treatment. These two have a child who is also considered a member of the same sect. The infant falls ill and faces imminent death without medical treatment, which his parents refuse. The state can intervene to save the infant's life, despite his or her parents' religious beliefs. Doesn't this infringe on the family's freedom of religion, another right explicitly recognized in the Constitution? The parents might argue so. But the Constitution doesn't give parents the right to cause an infant's death because of a parent's religious belief. The First Amendment to the Constitution protects freedom of speech, freedom of the press, religious freedom, the freedom to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for the redress of grievances. All these rights, though, are subject to reasonable limitations. Many members of the Oklahoma legislature believe that no restrictions can be placed on the use or ownership of guns because the right to keep and bear arms is mentioned in the Constitution. These legislators have advocated the repeal and prohibition of all firearm rules and regulations. They reference their efforts with the moniker Constitutional Carry, and come November 1st, their efforts will go into place. No president supports the ill-informed belief that a specific reference in the Constitution prohibits any limitations on the rights mentioned there. Only a tiny minority of Supreme Court justices has ever written in support of such absolutism, and never in a majority opinion. The rubric, Constitutional Carry, is abject nonsense drummed up by the paranoid and those who fetishize guns to manipulate people into thinking the right to carry a gun is absolute. If reasonable restrictions can be placed on the freedom of speech, of the press, of religion, and all the other freedoms we enjoy, reasonable restrictions can be put on the ownership and use of weapons as well.
Mark Dara is a writer and local attorney and a contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed any of our recent episodes, they're available online anytime on demand at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.